Good. Well, thank you very much for the invitation. Good to be here and good to see some old friends again. What I do in this paper is really pick up the story from the last volume, apply, adjust the framework I developed there, and see what's happened over the last 15 years. And of course, the story of Brexit and our friend Nigel is part of that. What I do is ask five questions. First, why is it that in a country characterized by such a high degree of institutional stability, really now only beginning to crack under the pressure of Brexit, a country with such a high degree of institutional stability, why have you had such radical policy swings? What role did migration play in the 2016 referendum on staying within the EU? Thirdly, what are the deeper historical reasons behind the Windrush scandal, Empire Windrush scandal, where large numbers of black Britons found themselves stripped of all the basic rights of citizenship? Fourthly, how well do existing theoretical accounts, does existing theory account for the evolution of immigration policy in the UK? And why are British politicians so crap? Question number five. Or putting that more formally, why is it that people in the Home Office, and above all the Home Secretary, have such a poor record of predicting the results of their own migration policy choices? So what are the radical policy swings, just to establish the empirical point? Well, from 1948 to 1962, 450 million people or so. No one really knows how big the British Empire was, but about that many had full citizenship rights in the United Kingdom. Two, from 1971 or 1973 to 1997, the UK was the quintessential zero immigration policy in intention and largely in effect. That was the title of Zig Leighton Henry's chapter back in 1994. Then after that, we get another flip. From 1997 to 2010, we have a huge expansion, a deliberate expansion of migration policy channels, and the UK goes from the bottom of the migration countries in Europe to near the top, competing as ever with Germany. And since 2010, we've had another policy flip, more in intention than in effect, an effort to reduce immigration in the UK to less than net 100,000 migrants per year. Theresa May has said three things many times: strong, stable, and fewer than 100,000 migrants. Now, just quickly to look at the numbers, this is really the new Labour story. Just look at the immigration line. At the top there, you get a doubling of migration. And again, that was very, very deliberate. That was a policy choice. So why was New Labour so open to immigration? Well, it was actually about ideas. The key actor in this was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown. And I refer you to Chris Wright, a young Australian academic's work on this. He's influenced my thinking greatly. But the Treasury was convinced of a particular theory of migration to which most of us in this room subscribe, that as you increase skilled migration, that improves human capital, and as your human capital expands, your productivity goes up, and that's good for the economy. The UK and Canada are in this intense competition for the lowest productivity levels in the world. I'm glad to say I think Canada's leading that race at the moment, but in response to that perpetual productivity problem in the UK, France actually has quite high productivity levels, migration was meant to solve it, and that was very much the application of theory to immigration policy. The second one was basically a classic British fit of the absence of the mind, John Seeley's famous line on the acquisition of the British Empire, opening the door to the newly acceded EU member states in 2004 seemed like, well, a jolly nice thing to do. It wasn't any more complicated than that. When you ask the Home Secretary at the time, Charles Clarke, or people in the Home Office, they say, well, you know, we supported enlargement, and since we supported enlargement, the logical extension of that seemed to be that we should be nice to the newly acceded members and let them in right away. Germany did not, France did not, Austria did not, on and on. Only Ireland, the UK, and Sweden did. And those clever social scientists assured them that there would be net EU migration of 5,000 to 13,000. And of course, as we all know, it ended up closer to 1 million. And that great upsurge in EU migration, which actually wasn't really wanted migration like the other channels opened by Labour, it simply happened because the channel was opened, that allowed the Conservative Party, which had been highly normatively boxed in on immigration because it couldn't appear to be racist or too racist, that allowed the Conservative Party to flip between 2005 to 2010 to an avowedly restrictionist party, and to do so in a way that was actually electorally beneficial to it. That's where we got the promise of fewer than 100,000 net migrants. Now, this was idiocy of the highest order, because anyone would have recognized that this figure was utterly unachievable. Why? Because once you added up family immigrants and EU immigrants, which were basically uncontrollable, you were above 100,000 anyway. So the Conservatives really set themselves up for failure. This led, in turn, to the hostile environment. So irony is not Theresa May's great strength, I think it's fair to say. If it were, she would recognize that there was something ironic about the Home Secretary, or sorry, the member of the Conservative Party before she was Home Secretary, that denounced at a Conservative Party conference the Conservatives as the nasty party. Rather ironic that she rolled out the nastiest immigration policy that one has seen in its tough competition for that spot. And this is basically an American idea, that if you make life miserable enough for undocumented migrants in the UK, they will, in that elegant expression of the English language, self-deport. They will simply go away. This policy was rolled out in 2013. Vans were going around London telling illegal migrants to go away. But going into the 2015 election, it was clear this was not working. Net immigration figures were so high, still very high, and the Conservatives have to cope with that. So they did two things in the Tory manifesto. First, you know, when you're in a hole, keep digging. They doubled down on the 100,000 promise, and they sealed their fate and that of the country, because they put in a promise of an in-out referendum on the European Union. And what's often forgotten, and I forgot myself until rereading the manifesto, is that it was linked very explicitly to immigration. So it was an in-out referendum after we secure a renegotiated, all the British and their renegotiations, a renegotiated deal on EU migration to the United Kingdom. That was the emergency break, the compromise that emerged before the referendum. And those of us who were in the UK will never forget this morning. This was the result. I got that at about 7 o'clock when I woke up, canceled all my appointments, and made one at noon with the bottle. And in fact, more than one bottle. That was the result. And early polling work just after the referendum by Lord Ashcroft found that 33% of Leave voters cited immigration as their primary reason for voting Leave. And, I mean, even this isn't social science, but everyone knew that when Leave came up with its simplistic but brilliant taking back control strategy slogan, it was control of over immigration as much as anything else that they were talking about. So that's the story of Brexit and immigration. Let's talk about the Empire Windrush scandal. And to begin, you know, with a story, because it's you can lose the tragedy in the statistics. In 2014, Renford McIntyre was subject to a random employment check. He produced national insurance contribution slips showing that he'd been working for 35 years and paying taxes, but he could not prove a right of residence in the United Kingdom. He lost his job, his flat, he ended up homeless, and this was happening up and down the country. People were losing bank accounts, they were losing jobs, they were getting kicked out of their flats. A significant number were deported, and some of those who were deported died, and there's been unconfirmed stories of suicide. It wasn't just any people. They were almost all black, almost all from the West Indies, and almost all low to medium income earners. In another irony, a much sadder irony, these were people who had only lived in, or had come to when they were very young, the UK, who didn't have the money for foreign holidays, for sabbaticals in Paris, had no reason to apply for a passport. They were the classic somewheres of Theresa May's conference speech, not the rootless, cosmopolitan, untrustworthy nowheres that make up the majority in this room. And they bore the brunt of this very, very inhumane policy. But why did it happen, is the question I ask. And to understand that, you need to go back to UK citizenship, because like no other country in Europe, UK immigration and immigration policy and immigration effects and immigration crises are bound up with citizenship law. So up until 1971, anyone who was a British subject was a citizen of the United Kingdom and colonies. So there was one citizenship for those in the British Isles, Britons we think of now, and one for those in the remaining colonies. And as the colonies became independent, people moved off that list. They were no longer CUKC. Well, the West Indians who came either came themselves on a CUKC passport, or they came with their parents when they were small children. And so here's the only one I could find, but this is a citizenship of the United Kingdom and Colonies passport, and I don't know if you could read it, but up here the date says January 1957. Well, that was before 1962, when British subjects had full entry rights to the UK, so they would have just come in with that passport. From 1962 to 1971, they had work permit schemes that gave advantage to the colonies. And then finally, from 1983, there was a British citizenship, a citizenship of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, for people who are what we now think of as British citizens. And these historical rights for the empire had been abandoned finally, or had been removed. But 57,000 West Indians were lost by this. They came in as CUKCs, as citizens of the United Kingdom and colonies. They didn't apply for a passport, because I said they weren't the sort of people who needed a passport. They were just getting on with their lives in the UK. But they lived happily in the United Kingdom. They went about living their lives, switched jobs, bought, sold houses, did all the sort of things that people do. What changed was the hostile environment. So Immigration Acts of 2014 and 2016 placed an obligation on a wide range of domestic actors to act like border control officials within the country. So this wasn't the externalization of the border a la Girardon. This was the radical internalization of the British border. And this was in a country in which ID cards are frequently denounced as a nasty bit of continental illiberalism. You'll see David Cameron mocking them in a bad German accent on YouTube, "Where are your papers?" We can't have that kind of thing in the United Kingdom. So what they did in this country so hostile to IDU cards and where there's absolutely no training is handed immigration control to a bunch of untrained officials, estate agents, people giving out driving licenses, opening bank accounts, and so on. And tens of thousands of Black Britons were absolutely slammed by this policy. And it was an incredibly callous policy that was incredibly incompetently implemented. And when the story broke, the Home Office couldn't even explain what had happened because they didn't understand their own imperial and citizenship history. All right, let me bring all that together, or try to. In the conclusion, I won't go into it, but I review theoretical accounts, pluralism, critical race theory, and Marxist functionalism, and I say that whilst there's something to all of them, they don't explain the trajectory above all these radical shifts, and they don't explain a particular preference sorting. So those most strongly in favor of capitalism, for example, in the United Kingdom, Enoch Powell or Margaret Thatcher, have been hardcore restrictionists, which means that Marxist functionalism certainly doesn't work. Rather, these radical shifts are a function, above all, of Westminster institutions. I think Antje mentioned them earlier in another context, that radically concentrate power in the hands of the executive. Now, of course, this is true of Australia and Canada. They have Westminster institutions, but the UK is particularly centralized. In Australia, I know the Canadian case, the provinces themselves are generally a check on executive power, but they also have an explicit legal role to play in immigration selection in Canada. See Jeff's work for some of this. And cities in the United Kingdom are incredibly weak. I mean, London was so weak that it didn't exist from 1986 until 1997. What I mean by that, the London County Council government was simply abolished. So American cities, like New York, handing out a New York ID card, have much more power than British cities. So this untrammeled power in the hands of the executives means the Home Secretary can flip immigration back and forth at will and often following ideological shifts. And all of this is embedded in an incredible structural ignorance on the part of UK politicians of their own immigration law and citizenship history. And the result of that is they introduced these sweeping policy changes in 48, in 2004, and in 2012, the hostile environment, without any sense of the radical implications that there is. And I'm afraid this ignorance of citizenship law and its powerful effects on immigration policy will continue. And the question is why, and I'll end with that, why are British politicians and the Home Office so uninformed? And I've decided that this is primarily Des's fault, and it's secondarily my fault. Yes, you. Because both Des and I'm only guilty of this for 4 years, Des for much longer, taught PPE, philosophy, politics, and economics at Oxford. No, I'm making a serious point here, which is that there's a cult of amateurism in the United Kingdom, and people who run the United Kingdom primarily study PPE, though I was glad to note from Simon Cooper's piece in the Financial Times, Simon lives here in Paris, that almost everyone who studied PPE voted Remain, and everyone who studied history or classics voted Leave. So Brexit is not our fault, Des, but this is partly our fault. Unlike on the continent, where you have a much more profound study of the law and where lawyers are much more actively engaged in politics and above all in the civil service, in the UK they are generalists through and through. And this history, if anything requires a lawyer, it's this one. So I'll stop with that. Thank you very much.